This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Claudia Wu, co-founder of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. We're lucky enough to have two guests on the show today who both have a connection to art, funny enough. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Danielle Chang of the Lucky Rice Festivals, but right now I'd like to welcome our first guest, Suzanne Cupps.
Hi.
Suzanne is chef de cuisine at Untitled, the fine dining restaurant at Renzo Piano's Whitney Museum of American Art, and the more casual Studio Cafe upstairs. This is the second restaurant she's worked at with Chef Michael Anthony, the first being Gramercy Tavern. So, Suzanne, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Danielle, also.
Hi, Claudia.
And feel free if you have any questions for Suzanne.
I will jump in.
But first of all, what an amazing place to go to work every day.
It is. It's such a unique space. You know, when Renzo built the museum, he had that the overarching thought of transparency. And so it's such a unique space to cook in, you know, open windows, open kitchen. You know, most chefs, most cooks are used to being in a not always dark, but an enclosed kitchen. So it's pretty fun to see what's going out, gone out outside with the weather, with the people.
Have you guys done any dishes inspired by the art? Does it inspire you as much as everyone, all the tourists who come in?
I think, you know, when Mike and I were moving from Gramercy, you know, one of the challenges was to think about the type of food we were serving. You know, we wanted to keep the same theme of local, seasonal American food. And the challenge was to figure out how to do it differently than Gramercy. And so when we were, you know, in the early stages, while the museum was and the space was still being built, coming up with those ideas were somewhat easy. But then, you know, also just how it looked on the plate, we wanted to make sure there was something a little different. And when we saw the restaurant and the actual, you know, area we'd be serving food in, it was pretty evident the changes and like the adaptations we needed to make. So definitely from the space, we pulled a lot of what we're doing now.
Yeah, this isn't the kind of museum restaurant where you can get a burger or
no.
steak or fries or anything like that. It's much more fine dining. How often do you guys change the menus and do new dishes?
So it is a seasonal restaurant, but we're not just changing it four times a year. You know, we have a vegetable forward menu that we're changing 2 to 3 dishes each week. So it makes for exciting for people that are coming in each week, for people that work in the museum to come down, but also just for our guests to get a taste of what's going on in the area, what kind of food's growing.
I've talked to a lot of people who have restaurants, and the winters in New York are a little challenging if you're doing vegetable-focused food. Do you guys come across that issue at all? Are you not focused on local? I mean, that's the only way to get around it, I think.
No, I mean, I think there's that idea that the winter has to be heavy dishes with, you know, heavy potatoes and squash, and that's all you can do. And, you know, we're fortunate enough to have such a wide group of farmers that, you know, have not just interesting products, but have great things that are in storage that, you know, we can use throughout the month. So what we're trying to do, we have a creative team of sous chefs and cooks that work for us. And what we're trying to do is come up with interesting ways to serve vegetables that maybe you haven't tried before. So it's not about, you know, getting some vegetable that you haven't seen necessarily, but just preparing it in a little lighter version. So winter doesn't equal, you know, just heavy cream dishes. You can do something different on the plate.
So let's go back a little bit, because I read in your bio that you were not the kind of kid who wanted to be in the kitchen with your mom when you were growing up. So how did food influence you when you were growing up? Like, what kind of things did you do?
Sure. It's funny that I don't mark a lot of time in my childhood by food experiences. You know, my grandpa and grandma, like, we always spent spent time in their kitchen hanging out, but I was never one to just jump in and really be an active part of it. My mom cooked every night when I was growing up, and it was something that I fought against. Just really had no interest. It wasn't that I was super picky, but I wasn't adventurous with cooking. My dad's Filipino, and my mom grew up in Pennsylvania, and my mom was the cook, but she cooked Filipino food. So we grew up eating a lot of rice and a lot of Asian dishes, which I wasn't a huge fan of. You know, I was an American child who wanted the staples. So it just wasn't something that was interesting to me. And I remember in some of my summers, especially when I was in high school, when I wasn't in school and I wasn't working, my mom would say, okay, once a week you have to cook dinner for the family. And every single week I would just get out of it some way, you know, figure out how to make her forget, or, you know, had something else to do. And it wasn't until college that I even was mildly interested in cooking, and really not even until I moved to New York and just was surrounded by the food culture here that I even, you know, thought about the idea of becoming a chef.
What do you think changed? I mean, to go from a picky eater to a chef at a fine dining restaurant, it's pretty dramatic.
I think, you know, I grew up in the South in South Carolina, and now there's some tremendous restaurants there. But, you know, my hometown was small, and it wasn't a food-centered, you know, where you had the food-centered was the hospitality at people's houses. It wasn't about going out to a ton of restaurants every night. And when you come to New York, it's just such a dramatic shift. You can realize right away, like, I had never paid $40 for a meal before. And when I got here, I just thought that was ridiculous. And so just right away, it hits you that, like, the importance is placed on food and restaurants in New York. And, you know, I fell into groups of friends that were interested in food. I ended up working at the Waldorf Astoria and kind of got that hospitality, food and beverage, you know, idea in my head. And it just kind of naturally, I think you get used to seeing the prices in New York pretty fast, whether you're shopping or eating or whatever you're doing. You know, I just had some really great meals and decided to give it a try.
So you ended up going to ICE.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly, I guess you started working for Danny Meyer. You externed there.
Yeah.
So how did how did that have an influence? Because, you know, now you're still working for Danny Meyer. You had a short break and you went to Anissa. But what influence did working there and externing there have on you as a chef?
Well, I want to say, when I went to culinary school, when I made that decision, I had never held a professional knife. I didn't really know what parsley and cilantro, like the difference between the herbs. I was really green. And I was lucky enough to hear about Gramercy Tavern. I had never eaten there before. And it was when Tom Colicchio was there, and got an externship where I worked about 3 days a week for 3 months. So it was real basic. I mean, I was chopping cabbage and cleaning mushrooms pretty much the whole time. But it was what I needed, because, you know, I didn't have any confidence going into restaurants. I didn't have any, my skills were, you know, my skill level was low. And so it really just, I didn't really know about Danny Meyer at that time. And I just kind of fell in love with the idea of cooking. And then when my externship was up, I got the job at Anissa, and, you know, worked for Anita for 5.5 years. And she was just tremendous mentor and teacher, and really just, you know, where school was great, and it's what I needed to get into the industry. Anita was the one who pushed me and taught me, and, you know, she was on the line every day then, and she was the one who you know, got me to stay in the industry, not just to start in it.
So it's more on the job mm-hmm. experience that sure. has really made you who you are.
Yeah, and then coming back to work at Gramercy again was, you know, a total different experience. Mike was the chef, Mike Anthony, when I returned, and his food philosophy just from the beginning, you know, when I went to Gramercy, I thought I'd stay in the business another year or so, and just really got hooked in into what he was doing there.
What were your plans if you didn't stay?
I don't know. Food was interesting to me, and I have a kind of a mathematical mind, and I like the precision. I'm definitely a perfectionist when it comes to cooking and other areas of life. And so So cooking really was exciting for me in that aspect. But I wasn't sold. I wasn't hooked. And working for Mike, just the style of the kitchen, his food, his philosophy, how it's not just about working your station, whether you're plating salads, you're not just plating salads, you're learning about the business, how to run it, how to manage it, even as a new cook, was a difference. And so I fell in love with doing that, and was lucky enough to get the opportunities to put me where I am now.
Do you think culinary school was worth it? We've had this question at our Jubilee conference before.
I mean, for me, 100%. I mean, granted, I went to Clemson in South Carolina for undergraduate, and I'm very proud of it. But 4 years at Clemson was less expensive than 6 months of culinary school for me.
yeah.
So it's a little crazy when you compare the prices, but for me, like I said, I would have never had the confidence to even set foot into a kitchen if I hadn't have been there. I didn't, have any basic knowledge. So if I had walked in, it would have been I wouldn't have gotten the job at Anissa. I wouldn't have had an externship at Gramercy. So for me, it put me in the right places.
Can you tell a difference working at a place like Anissa, where it's Anita Lowe's one restaurant, it's like her baby, mm-hmm. to somewhere like Gramercy or Untitled, where it's like Danny Meyer has like a whole sure. hospitality group behind it? Is there a difference working at some two different places like that?
I mean, I definitely think there's a difference. I think, people, there's good positives on either side. For me, the smaller restaurant, the chef-owned restaurant was the way to go first. It was just, it was a small kitchen. The focus was a little bit smaller. And when you start working in a bigger restaurant group like USHG, there's so many opportunities and so many things to look at and to see. I think when I started out, that wasn't the right route for me. But I think the great thing about working in the company I do is that even though, it is large and there's lots of opportunities, each restaurant is so unique and different. So it's not like you're going in and you feel like you're working, like at Untitled, I don't feel like I'm working at Gramercy Tavern. We have a lot of similar cultural values and we, a lot of our techniques are similar, but it's a different restaurant. And it's amazing that Danny's able to, have so many places that feel the same hospitality wise, but are, such vast different styles. So that, I think that's a cool thing.
Have you guys done away with tipping yet at Untitled? Are you on the list?
We're on the list. Not quite yet, but it's coming soon. So yeah, we're excited. It's, the moderns had such, great stories to tell about their experience. And, we're such a new restaurant. We've only been open 9 months. So we're looking forward. Every week seems like a different change and something new on the horizon. We just started doing our weekend lunches. Some people would call it brunch.
Yes. Don't say the B word while you're in there. It's a weekend lunch.
But, it's fun. We're doing our vegetable focused menu. So it's similar if you come to lunch during the week or if you come at dinner, you're not going to see a vast change, but we're adding some eggs and some things that people like to eat on the weekends. So, every week is a little bit different, trying out some new things.
Yeah, and I highly recommend it. The Whitney's basically, the High Line is right there. Mm-hmm. You've got the river. The views in the museum are amazing. And then and upstairs you guys have the Studio Cafe as well, which is a simpler menu, right?
So it's still, the studio is still, we're getting the same produce locally. It's just the presentation is different. So it's a little more casual than Untitled. We're doing vegetable dishes, but we're putting them on toast, like open-faced sandwiches. We're making house-made ramens and salads. And, it's a fun way to be able to see the museum and have a great meal at the same time. And the back of house for us, we treat the two spaces together. So it's not completely two separate restaurants where our cooks rotate through the spaces and it's, one entity. So it makes it, we're able to kind of keep those same values between the two restaurants.
Well, great. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and we'll talk to Danielle and we'll figure out what her connection to art is.
Boys and girls are on fire. Do you love chocolate? Turn your passion into a profession with École Chocolat School of Chocolate Arts. This award-winning school offers many programs for chocolate making, so you can master techniques and gain the expertise and business knowledge you need to become a professional chocolate maker. You'll create mouth-watering chocolate recipes from professional instructors while interacting with your classmates and tutors, all online. Become a chocolate expert with École Chocolat via your computer, phone, or tablet. Pursue your passion for chocolate. Visit écolechocolat.com today.
Welcome back. Our next guest is Danielle Chang. She's the founder of Lucky Rice, a platform for Asian culture. In 2010, Lucky Rice started out as a food festival, but has expanded into a multidisciplinary agency that includes a consulting arm, a PBS series called Lucky Chow, and now a new book. Lucky Rice, Stories and Recipes from Night Markets, Feasts, and Family Tables is out just in time for the Lunar New Year, which might be the biggest party on the planet.
Right? Well, it's definitely the largest holiday or the most widely celebrated holiday in the world because it is the most important time of the year for the Chinese who, as we all know, take up a large part of this earth.
And it's the year of the monkey.
Yes.
Do you know what that means? I always wonder. Like,
well, monkeys like to monkey around. They're known for being playful and creative. And this is actually the year of the fire monkey. So you have the fiery sign as well. So it's something that only comes around every 60 years.
Wow.
So it's supposed to be a really passionate, kind of crazy, fun year.
Oh, good. Well, something to look forward to.
Yes.
What's your sign?
I'm the pig.
You're the pig.
But
what
you
does
know,
that mean?
That, you just basically asked me how old I am.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
No, yeah.
Because
it's a 12-year cycle, so she's...
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm 44. And, you know, anybody who knows their zodiac signs knows how old anybody is.
Suzanne,
like the back of their head.
Actually, I don't know mine.
Oh,
I'm 35.
You're 35. Well, I unfortunately don't have the zodiac calendar memorized in my head.
What was last year?
It's the... Oh, you're putting me on the spot.
Oh, my God.
No,
sorry.
Was
it a sheep?
Exactly. It's the year of the sheep. I know that because my daughter's 12 and she's the year of the sheep. So I'm a bad mommy.
So, Suzanne, the year after this is your year.
Okay.
Your birth year. So whatever's after monkey.
So next year is my year.
Next year.
Yes. Can't wait.
Yes.
So I talked about your connection with art, and I had no idea. Danielle's had a very varied career before this. So you worked at the New York Times.
Yes.
And later you founded and published your own magazine.
Yes.
And then you got your master's from Columbia in critical theory. And you were,
and I sound a bit schizo here, but it all fits together somehow.
Yeah. And you're a professor of contemporary art history and a curator of emerging art.
Yeah,
That's crazy.
I mean, it all kind of fits together. You know, my focus has always been on telling stories about pop culture. And so I studied art history in college, then actually went on and got my master's after working galleries. I was the director of Jeffrey Deitch and Andrea Rosen at a point and curated exhibits and started teaching in Rochester while I was in grad school. And then decided to leave an academic pursuit, but always wanted to be telling stories and fascinated by the idea of telling stories about my heritage and the lifestyle through food and culture that I grew up with in Taiwan. So now that's what I do. And instead of using, you know, art as my paintbrush, so to speak, it's really food is the lens through which I tell stories about popular culture.
It's so fun because especially with Asian food, I think there's so many stories to tell. It's such an integral part of the culture. We're always eating.
I agree.
Are always eating.
Yeah. I mean, food is the heartbeat of Asian culture. And anybody who's lived there or has traveled there knows how important night markets and food courts and just the daily rhythms of home cooking are to it's as essential as living and breathing and eating, right? But, you know, I think what I wanted to bring with the cookbook is exactly what you're talking about, the kind of backstory to all the dishes, because I'm not a chef, and I'm approaching it from a different perspective. And I think there's so many cookbooks out there already that kind of give you a broad overview of, say, 100 Pan-Asian dishes, and that's not... I just don't think that there's a need to create another cookbook about that. So, you know, instead with Lucky Rice, I've kind of chosen stories that I think take a pulse on what's happening today in our dining culture and how influenced it is by Asian food trends, ingredients.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter on, like, the fusion of Asians, like the kimchi. You have kimchi tacos in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think it's through food that we're understanding so much about culture, period, and especially Asian culture. You know, I really wanted to, as I said, had this lifelong ambition to tell these stories about my heritage. And it's really through the lens of food that people are finally waking up and learning the differences between, say, various regions in China, or even the difference between various countries in Asia. And that is amazing, like, especially with, say, Filipino cuisine. I feel that a lot of people are understanding a lot about the Philippines and its diverse geography and, you know, history of colonialization, but it's all through this lens of food. And as well, you know, I love how ingredients like fish sauce and kimchi and dishes like ramen and banh mi are part of our everyday grub. Mm-hmm. And they really, you know, I don't think, you know, we go out for ethnic food today and end up at a ramen shop. It is just what we put into our mouths. And so, you know, you can call it a mashup or you can call it a fusion cuisine, but I really think that it's just, you know, what is exciting today about our food world.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that David Chang just opened a restaurant, which is Italian, but he's not using Italian ingredients. He's using Asian ingredients, basically.
Yeah, and I love that. You know, I think that, I mean, well, David's such an amazing chef, and he's done so much to help us see outside the boundaries of what constitutes any one cuisine. Certainly, you know, as a Korean chef, going into creating a Japanese ramen chef with all of these various influences, that was really eye-opening to so many, and also delicious to our bellies. And it's great that he's kind of paved a way, I mean, as have other chefs, where we can create dishes that have nothing to do with our ethnic identity or boundaries of where we live.
Yeah, so. It's just about what we like to eat, you know?
Yeah.
We all have everyone has their tastes and, like, different influences growing up. So, you know, what's comfort food to someone might not be to other people. And it's just nice to, I guess that's the whole creative process. And that's why it's called culinary arts.
It is. Yes.
So what is, what's up for you in the year with Lucky Rice? What are your big plans this year?
Well, I can't believe it's our seventh year already. When I first started Lucky Rice, 7 years ago, it was a 1 week New York festival, and now we've expanded into 8 different cities, mostly in the East and West Coast. And this year we're going to Houston for the first time. I'm excited about that.
Is that your hometown? You grew up there a little
bit. Well, I tried to hide it, but yeah, I'm a Texan at heart. No, but actually I did spend 10 years in Texas after I moved from Taiwan when I was 5. And so back then in the mid-70s, I was the only Asian person in my entire school. And now there's been so many waves of immigration, not just the Chinese, but the Vietnamese, the Korean, to Houston. And I'm so excited to go back there and check it out. I actually have to admit that I have not been back to Texas since I left. but it's such a hotbed for culinary talent. And excited to see where Korean and Korean Tex-Mex barbecue is going, where, you know, Vietnamese shrimp boat farmers are heading with their Cajun boils. And there's just smoked meats. There's so much in that heartland.
And your book is out now, yes. I think. Well, by the time this airs, it'll be out.
The book comes out on January 26th.
So be sure to pick it up. We are going to do a speed round, a dual, a two-person speed round. We haven't done this in a while. let's see. So to both of you, coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Whoa. How do you guys take it?
Black.
Blue bottle, iced New Orleans.
Oh, my God.
Ooh, very specific.
What's in your refrigerator right now?
Kimchi. I just made a huge vat, so that don't open your my refrigerator at your peril.
Eggs and old bread right now.
What are some of your favorite foods to eat?
Kimchi.
Obviously.
With fried rice and runny eggs.
Anything Japanese and eggs.
Do you guys have go-to spots that you go to in the city? Like, what are your favorite places to go?
I love El Rey on the Lower East Side, and a fan of Black Seed Bagels, too.
Mm, I love Black Seed Bagels, but top of my list is Untitled right now.
Good answer.
Is there anything you guys absolutely will not eat?
I have a lot of aversion, so, you know, some of parsley is one of those things I don't love.
You know, I actually, it's funny, a lot of fermented foods just don't bode well with me, like really stinky cheeses, really? Even though obviously I love the fermented funky flavors of like fish sauce, like that to me just smells so delicious. Parmesan doesn't do it for me.
Uh-huh. Favorite drink?
Wine.
I'm a water coffee person. That's about it for me.
What's your favorite kitchen tool?
Well, beside my knife, the rubber spatula. You have to, only way to cook. And tweezers.
Yeah, I'd say my Japanese mandolin.
How did you come up with the recipes, by the way? Did you develop them yourself, or you curated them?
I developed all the recipes myself, but clearly, you know, a lot of the dishes that I include, things like Jewish pastrami egg rolls, thank you, Ed Schoenfeld, or, you know, kimchi tacos, thank you, Roy Choi, are dishes that I came across just from my years of curating Lucky Rice.
What's your work-life balance like?
It'll get better.
I mean, 9 months is not a long time.
Yeah.
Right.
No, it's good. You know, I think it's great when you're at work, and when you're at home, you have a couple minutes to rest and just recharge and get back at it.
Nonstop. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that it's probably all the time, not all at once. So, you know, yeah, it's counter to what people told us when we were growing up or in college. Yeah. You know, you can have it all, and you can have it all now. That's just not true.
I just read somewhere that you should think about a problem for 8 hours and work 2.
That's a really great solution. That's what I do when I'm sleepless at night.
If you guys were not doing what you're doing right now, what would you be doing? Or what do you think you would be doing?
I know. I would want your job. Seriously, magazines are still my first love. And
they're hard
I would
to shake.
I would give anything to publish a print magazine as beautiful as Cherry Bomb. It just must be so much fun. And to talk about women and food.
Yeah.
I struggled to find this career. And so there's nothing else that really, especially as a woman, that I would rather be doing. However, I've always said that if I had been born of the other sex, a guy, I would definitely be a professional football player.
Really?
100%.
Well, I don't think you should let, you know, anything stop you.
I don't really want to watch women play football, so, but if I were a guy.
What's your team?
Well, for college, Clemson, and we were in the championship game. We almost won, unfortunately. In professional, I'm a Broncos fan.
Nice. So, yeah. Where do you guys want to travel to next?
Spain, definitely. And Japan. Those are top two.
Africa.
Oh, really? Is there anywhere in the world that you haven't gone yet and eaten, Danielle, besides Africa?
Oh, so many places.
Really?
Actually, I really want to visit a lot of night markets that I've never been to. Like, I've never been to Malaysia. I'm dying to see if their night markets are better than Singapore's. Just kidding. I'm not going to cause any, you know, cross-strait antagonism there. But I love to eat my way around the night markets of Asia.
I love going to night markets in Taiwan, but I could never bring myself to buy the insects on a stick. Something that I cannot do.
Come on, Claudia. I'm teasing.
Anything with a face on it, staring right. at you is like very hard. Well, thanks both of you for being here today. That's
Thank
it
you.
For this week's episode. Thanks for listening in.
Hi, this is Priya Krishna. I'm the marketing manager at Lucky Peach and the author of Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Heritage Radio Network and Cherry Bomb Magazine. For more information on the magazine or to subscribe, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Angela DeMiuga, the executive chef of Mission Chinese Food, because she's effortlessly cool and cooks food that's on her own terms.